This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we will talk with the fabled political consultant, Gus Weil. Big stories this week emanating from Louisiana, and Gus will opine about Steve Scalise becoming the highest-ranked U.S. House official in Louisiana since Hale Boggs in 1972. It's been a meteoric rise for Congressman Scalise. He's now the whip of the majority, and he was elected when Bobby Jindal became governor. So Steve Scalise has only been in Congress for 6 years. He's number three man among the Republican majority. Also, Susan Mizrucci, Brando Smile, is her book about Marlon Brando. He came to New York in 1943 as a 19-year-old kid from Nebraska. In 4 years, he was one of the great artists of his time. We'll talk about it. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, your number outside the area, 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We start with Gus Weil, the veteran political consultant who has advised some of the greats in Louisiana and national history, and he is now opining from his perch in an area not too far from our studios. Good morning to you, Gus Weil.
Good morning, Jim.
In lovely Livonia, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, Steve Scalise, the man from Jefferson Parish, who just 6 years ago became a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, succeeding Bobby Jindal, May 3rd, 2008, Scalise takes the oath of office. He's now the number three person in the leadership of the House's ruling Republicans, the House Whip. Steve Scalise, at 48, appears to be on a far faster track to national hierarchy than does Governor Bobby Jindal.
Isn't that ironic? So much for the ambitions of men and how they finally play out.
It is ironic that Governor Jindal is trying very hard to be president of the United States, and it could happen. And I wouldn't count him out. His chances may be as good as anybody else's, but let's face it, the chances of him being president are not high, and the chances of Steve Scalise being speaker, or perhaps, who knows, maybe he has presidential aspirations. I would say the whip in the U.S. House of Representatives, as far as a national scale, exceeds being governor of Louisiana.
I don't know. It depends on a man's personal ambitions. When you're up there in Washington, no matter how high you rank, you're one of many. Whereas within a state, you're by yourself. You're the man. So I don't know. It depends how a person would look upon that.
Well,
you know?
it's all on how you look at it, and you saw that up close and personal. Hale Boggs, when Governor McKithen was in office, you're the man you helped get elect. Hale Boggs was the number three guy in the House of Representatives. He was a Democrat.
Yes.
Died in 1972 when Governor McKithen had just left office. But he was a guy who had great national appeal out of New Orleans. But yet in the state of Louisiana, Governor John McKithen was the kingpin.
And here is the key to that. I saw Boggs many times with McKithen, and he was so solicitous and almost childlike, because remember, McKithen could have turned out the vote that would have defeated him or elected him. That's how powerful a Louisiana governor like McKithen was. McKithen removed Gillis Long from office, mm-hmm. as an example. So Boggs was, I think, a great man. But he minded his P's and Q's around John McKithen.
All right. And I'm reminded by a listener, and it's a good observation from Ernie, that Bob Livingston almost became Speaker of the House, the number one.
And personal scandal removed him from all of that. And so he did something very intelligent. He became a monumentally successful lobbyist.
But he could have been a contender, and by his own admission, he on this show, he said he could have done a lot for Louisiana, but
yes.
But he messed it up with his personal indiscretions.
You know, it depends on the man, though, Jim. For example, I know some men who I would love to see in a position like Congressman Scalise, because I know that they would be good to this state. But I've also known some politicians who, once they get out of Louisiana, they just as soon never come back. Most of our congressmen, when they finally leave office, do not live in Louisiana.
Well, there was some speculation that if David Vitter was elected governor, that he might appoint Scalise to be the U.S. Senator succeeding Vitter.
Yes.
And Vitter will have that pleasure if he is elected governor. He'll get to appoint a successor. But now that Scalise has ascended to the number three spot in the U.S. House of Representatives among the Republican majority, my guess is that he wants to stay there, which means that Governor Vitter should go shopping elsewhere. Perhaps he'll appoint you, Gus.
Well, son, there's an excellent possibility because my credentials in the Republican Party are unequaled.
Well, he could do a lot worse.
Thank you.
And it certainly would make news if Gus Weil went to Washington and joined Congressman Edwards on Capitol Hill.
There you are.
Well, what about Bobby Jindal? He's running for president. He's made news this week by shutting down Common Core in Louisiana. And even his close allies, some of them, like LABI, they are criticizing him for doing this. What's going on with our governor?
Well, you know, I have no personal axe to grind. I'm an 82-year-old man. And
hey, wait a minute. You're only 81, Gus.
Born on 82. And age consigns me to where I belong, the sidelines. I believe that we should clear out and let the young play out their lives, as we did.
Well, but go ahead.
The reason I put that introduction is because what I'm going to say is pretty tough. If I were Governor Jindal, I would go through some extreme personal soul-searching. I would ask myself this question. Shall I continue as governor in this sad southern state, which ranks last in so many important areas? Should I tend it like a mother tends a child and give it all of my talents and ambitions? Or should I go ahead and resign and run for president of the United States? He has already spent, I think, something like 85 days a year out of this state. This state can't afford a part-time governor. Doesn't anybody see what's going on here? In other words, if I were Jindal, I would resign if I wanted to run for president.
Well, the only person I've known to resign in modern times to run for one office and leave another is David Vitter. He resigned his seat in the Louisiana House to run for Congress, saying it was the right thing to do. Now, the question is whether Senator Vitter will resign his U.S. Senate seat to run for governor next year. My guess is that he will not. But
well, if I was him, I wouldn't resign too quick.
But Bobby Jindal, yeah, there you go. Bobby Jindal is doing the same thing that Jimmy Carter did when he was governor of Georgia. And I take that back. Carter had already left office when he ran for president. He only served one term, so we can't count him. Okay, but what about Bill Clinton when he was governor of Arkansas? What about Ronald Reagan when he ran? Well, he ran for governor or ran for president twice when he was governor of California.
Those are all good considerations, but I don't want to diffuse this moment and my counsel, which is, and at this time, either be governor or be a candidate for president. There is no way that this man and this state can do both. None.
Well, Governor Foster was criticized for not going out of state enough.
Yeah, Mike Foster really tended to his job, though. He stayed. He was on it. I kind of think at that time it was a good thing. And it was his personality and his age. So many factors play into it.
Well, I think history will remember him as a good governor. But he gave us the Stelly Plan, by the way. He went to law school while he was governor. That would seem to be a distraction. Not many chief executives of a state do that.
Well, and I would discuss him at another time if you wanted to devote a program to him. But I'm narrowing in on our present circumstances. You know, it is so easy, as I said, to diffuse the reality of the moment with other considerations.
All right. Well, Christie says Mike Foster also gave us Bobby Jindal, and that he did. without Mike Foster, there would be no Bobby Jindal.
I would bet Foster regrets that. I've never asked him, but I would believe he would regret that.
I'm not sure about that, but I doubt that they talk very much because Bobby Jindal has his eye on the presidency. Now, when I was growing up, and when you were growing up, and we're a generation apart, being governor of Louisiana was, it was tall cotton, heady stuff. And
the very important point. Speaking of Governor Foster, you said that you doubt that he and Governor Jindal talk very much.
I do.
I submit that they never talk. And who's the loser for that? Mike Foster had, 8 years experience as governor, and for this man not to consult with him virtually every month and see, I don't think the general talks to anybody but some people who he surrounds himself with because they tell him he's going to be president.
Well, Governor Jindal has thrown a bone to Governor Foster by agreeing to a $3 million library in St. Mary Parish to honor Governor Foster. And,
yes.
And that's certainly a waste of taxpayer money. It's money that should have been raised privately. And here we are in a budget crunch, and we're spending money on frivolous items like this.
Of course.
And yet people who like Governor Foster, as you do and I do, John Kennedy does. John Kennedy, who's the big watchdog on spending, he's defending this expenditure. What do you think of this, Gus Weil?
Well, he's an office holder and a politician, and office holders and politicians have to put everything aside for one thing, to be reelected. And I think that was what that would be based on, that decision by him.
Well, Governor Jindal supposedly plays hardball, and we're going to find out because his superintendent of education is bucking him in the most grand way on Common Core. Can John White hold his job with him not being in accord with the governor on this most important issue in education?
I don't know, but I tell you what, I hope we don't lose a guy like that. I think he's one of Jindal's best appointments. I would hope we don't. And how about the federal money he's turned down for Medicaid? How many millions was that? Can you imagine this broke state turning down millions of dollars of federal money to help people with their sicknesses and ailments?
Well, he's turned down money for broadband. The governor has. He's turned down money for a rail system from Baton Rouge to New Orleans. He doesn't like federal money, although... Governor, when he was a member of Congress, he certainly accepted his federal paycheck.
Yes, I believe that.
You know, that's something that I admire from people like Schwarzenegger. He didn't take a check when he was governor of California.
No.
If you believe in...
He was awfully busy with the maid, though.
But if you believe in less government or no government, whatever, and you really want to show you believe it, well, then don't take your check.
Well, it always applies to everybody but me.
Right.
Yeah, the equation must always leave me out. Let me tend to your business, not mine, you know?
Well, Governor Jindal, for a man who doesn't like government, when's the last time he had a job outside of government?
I'm not aware that he has ever held another job. I think he's either been an elected or appointed official. I don't think, I'm thinking back, I doubt that he's ever had a job.
He worked for the McKinsey Company for about 6 months, I think, so that would be in the private sector.
Who are they?
They're a big consulting firm, biggest consulting firm in the United States. They produce Stephen Moray as well, a lot of bright people, usually Ivy Leaguers. They come out of that company, and they go on to do great things.
Yes. I don't think that would be one of the tags attached to his name. I think that he's going to go down, and I'm serious, in Louisiana history, as perhaps our worst governor in many, many decades.
Worse than
anybody
else. Worse than Edwin Edwards.
Oh, yes, because Edwards helped a lot of people and did a lot of good things. I'm not saying that Edwards is faultless or guiltless or that his hands are lily white, but he did a lot of things.
Worse than Dick Lesh.
Well, now you're taking me to the penitentiary again.
We'll be back in 90 seconds with Gus Weil on WRKF. 297-5633, your number. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. The veteran political consultant, Gus Weil, is with us. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Hi, Phil. You're on the air with Gus.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Mr. Weil.
Hello, son.
Yes, sir. I have to say and ask a question, but I think Mr. Jindal is prime example of everything that characterizes the modern Republican Party. They put party and ideology ahead of the needs of people who need the insurance. Exxon has been using millions of gallons of water every day in their process, and nothing's done about that. That's groundwater. And now the Coast lawsuit has been squashed before it even, you know, it retroactively killed it. I mean, what the hell? So I would challenge anyone to say what good has the Republican Party done for the American public, sir?
Well, let me say that the Democrat Party is not perfect either, you know. We've produced some awful losers. So I don't want to be sided as somebody who's a Republican or a Democrat. I have voted both. But Jindal is unique in my experience, and I don't think the people in Louisiana realize that there's something they can do about it.
What can the people do about it?
The people can start forming a petition to recall him. Just recall him. I think that he should be I think he should be presented with the facts of the case, what he has, the neglect that he has wrought upon this state, and then given a choice of continuing or going on and running for president. I really believe it's that serious. See, I don't think this state can stand absentee leadership.
He got 54% the first time he ran in 2007, the second time he ran, but first time he won, and then he got 66% when he ran for re-election. I think in his mind he has been validated.
Well, you can understand him feeling that way because he's not a victim of him. In fact, he's a benefactor.
Well, I don't know that he would win again, but he's not running again in Louisiana. He's probably run his last race here other than presidential primaries. And he's now making his case to the fine people of Iowa and New Hampshire, and that may be why he nixed Common Core, probably is.
But the nerve of him going about this country telling people how to solve their problems, that's what presidents do, you know, solve major, massive problems. But his nerve in doing that, when they can't solve minuscule problems in Louisiana, he can't or hasn't.
297-5633 is your number. Now, the legislature could swing into action. That's not going to happen either. It's a Republican-dominated legislature, and but one caller says they could impeach him for malfeasance. Well, let's get real. That's not going to happen.
No.
And a recall petition's not going to work. It would get some publicity, but they're not going to get enough valid signatures to force a recall of this governor.
I'll tell you what it would do, though. It sure would pretty much end his presidential business.
Well, let him run, and if he won, Gus, wouldn't it be good for the state of Louisiana?
To get him out of here?
No, well, he's going to be out anyway, but wouldn't it be good for him to be president?
Well, I don't know if a guy like that would feel any sense of appreciation and do anything for his state. I really don't. I don't think he operates on those lines. I think that there is a selfish, one-world sort of a mentality there, a fine mentality. He's very bright. But I think it's all aimed and focused on him.
877-217-5757, wherever you are, Inkster Show at WRKF.org for Gus Weil. And another listener, Amy, notes that, Gus, if you don't like Governor Jindal, you should be real happy if and when David Bruce Vitter becomes the governor of Louisiana. That may very well happen.
Well, I want to tell you, I don't think it will, but I was amused that Vitter, in the town hall he had, he suddenly got to the left of Jindal.
He did? He didn't take any positions, and it may be because he doesn't have any positions, or it may be because he doesn't want to get boxed in.
It's the exact opposite of the way that he has voted in Washington. Could have been two different people.
Yeah, he was noncommittal. In fact, at one point he said everything's on the table.
Yeah.
Which, the way I understand it, that would mean that he might be in favor of some tax increases. Governor Jindal has not.
Hold your breath.
But they've all taken this tax pledge from Grover Norquist, no tax pledge, and Governor Jindal has stayed true to this because he wants to run for president, and he doesn't want to come across as George H.W. Bush did when he said no new taxes in 1988 in the Louisiana Superdome when he became the Republican nominee for president. And then he put through a tax hike, and he paid dearly when Bill Clinton and Ross Perot were out attacking him in 1992. So the governors don't want to pardon anybody who's going to go out and perhaps commit a crime. They don't want to raise taxes. So with these governors who are vying to be president, Gus, it looks like they're just biding time and hoping they can get through 4 or 8 years.
You're right. That ambition seems to have a deadly effect on the office holder from a standpoint of his immediate constituency, i.e. the people of Louisiana.
And I don't know that that is untrue of others in other states, governors who are trying to be president right now, because we've seen how actions by Michael Dukakis, by Bill Clinton.
But thank God we're just talking about Louisiana right now, mm-hmm. You know. In other words, if we expand this into other states, we're changing the complexion of the issue completely. I have a very narrow focus. You see, you're on the air 5 times a week. I'm on the air once a month when you're kind enough to have me. So I've got to stick to my state. I love this state, and I just hate to see it so neglected.
You know, the other day I got a call from a guy, actually it was an email from Mark Jacobson of New York Magazine, who said he listens to this show in New York online, and that he loves Gus Weil, that you're his favorite guest. And I gave him your number. Did he contact you?
He did contact me, and we talked for an hour or so. Very bright man, and I was a little intimidated. Very bright.
And he's a good friend of the new mayor of New York.
Yes, he is. He's de Blasio, I think.
Yes, yes. And you, of course, lived in New York most recently.
Yeah, but when I lived there, Bloomberg was the mayor. And he was a great mayor because he was so rich that he didn't want anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he never stole anything. And he could concentrate completely. Tell you what Bloomberg did. He hired the brightest people he could find and turned his business over to them. And he ran New York on a day-to-day basis. Did not take a salary. He was an amazing.
That's right. He's another one. He did not take a salary.
Did not take a salary.
No.
He's also it's kind of interesting. He's the wealthiest man in New York. He is the wealthiest man in New York. I think it's somewhere now between $18 and $20 billion. That's richer than you.
Yeah. All right. You know, Ted Turner was worth about that much at one point, and he's down to $1 billion now. And I remember him saying that, you know, with good money management, you can go a long way on $1 billion.
I wonder how much of that Jane Fonda got.
I don't know, but I think Jane's doing well in her own right. But Ted, he has, at last count, 4 different relationships, 4 ladies in 4 different cities, and he spends 1 week a month with each lady. What kind of a lifestyle is that, Gus Weil?
Sounds pretty good. That coming from an old man is good for a laugh.
Well, Ted's about your age.
Well, maybe I ought to just talk for myself and not indict all the aged creatures.
Well, that's an immoral lifestyle, though, isn't it?
What's that?
I said that's an immoral lifestyle, isn't it, to have 4...
Yeah, you know, it's a very personal lifestyle, and I would consider it an immoral lifestyle, but on the other hand, you'll not find me critical of things like that. How people lead mm-hmm. their lives, the most intimate parts of their lives, it's kind of up to them, you know, as long as they don't bother anyone else.
I read in Sunday's Advocate that Donald Trump, who was seated beside Jay Darden at the Miss USA pageant, according to Lieutenant Governor Darden, the Donald was making comments about the women's bodies as they sashayed on the stage at the pageant. Imagine that. Should Jay Darden have stood up and popped the Donald right there on national television?
Well, I think that Donald Trump is a wealthy buffoon. I think he's an egomaniac, and I think he's a buffoon. I remember that long after it was over, he was still trying to find out that President Obama was not an American citizen. What more could you say about him? He's a genuine fool.
But he's managed to create a brand that is enormous for a guy who went bankrupt. And as Bill Maher said right here on this show, imagine going bankrupt when you're in the casino business, Gus Weil.
You're right. The casino business, it can be good, but it can be bad, too.
All right. Another listener, Tucker, asks about the mayor of New York, the new mayor, de Blasio.
Yeah.
He has an African-American wife.
Yes.
She has acknowledged that her relationship with him is her first heterosexual relationship, that she led a gay lifestyle prior to meeting the mayor. Could this man be elected mayor of Baton Rouge?
Well, you know, I don't think so. I think that, on the other hand, it certainly gives him a mixed constituency, doesn't it? He was not, I never knew anything about him because I had moved back to Louisiana by the time that he was elected. He'll probably last one term.
Well, he's a man who defied the odds, and he's lived his life as he sees fit, and I don't see anything wrong with what he's done.
In the words of Frank Sinatra, he lived his life his way.
But here in Little Baton Rouge, the East Baton Rouge Parish Council has been unwilling to pass an ordinance that would basically allow no discrimination in employment, public accommodation, and housing on the basis of race, religion, color, national origin, age, disability, sex, veterans status, gender identity, and sexual orientation. The Baton Rouge Metro Council will not, at least to this point, embrace this despite the support of Mayor Holden. Why has our community done something that in New York, for example, they would think was backward as far as
Louisiana,
not embracing this?
Specifically Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and I dearly love Baton Rouge, but we are the most racially divided community that I have ever been in, and it governs almost everything that you see happening in Baton Rouge, black and white and black. It's been that way, and I don't see anything changing it.
But you told a telling story once, Gus, when you were advising Governor McKithen, and he went to a national governor's conference, and he started getting a lecture from the governor of Minnesota about race, and what did the governor do?
Yes, John McKithen said, "May I ask what percent of your population is African American?" And it was virtually none. So they had no problems. Everybody was the same.
And in Louisiana, we have
a third,
and in Mississippi, almost two-fifths African American. And yet, the two states that unfortunately have had the most history of racial division are most likely, if you were to pick two, Mississippi and Louisiana.
Yes. But Baton Rouge is an extreme town, even for this state. You know, that's the way we used to think of Shreveport, but it's not that way anymore. Baton Rouge, I think now, is the most racially divided city, in Louisiana.
Well, your former protege, James Carville, has noted that we should not focus exclusively on the kinds of things that you and I are talking about. We should also note that Baton Rouge has a black mayor, that New Orleans has a white mayor, that we have an Indian American as governor, that we've done some things. We've been certainly ahead of the pack in electing women in Louisiana. Some things have been progressive in this state.
Well, we can't be all bad, you know. And if you look hard enough, you can find exemptions in every situation where something isn't all white or all black. Mm-hmm. There's some gray in there, and that's right. But the overall, we've got to be, here's my point, we've got to be so careful not to color our thinking with these generalities that take our eyes off the ball. Mm-hmm. The ball is the lives of the people of this state. That's what we have to think about. The people who have no voice, none, never represented, and are not being represented now.
Steve Wynum, the former budget director of the state under Governor Romer, says to Gus Weil, he's unafraid to express his opinions, has gravitas, and is at the top of his game today. Gus started his career as a worker for, and when I say a worker, he was at high levels when John Kennedy ran for president. And the other day we had a conversation about the Catholic vote in presidential elections. You know, every election since 1972, Roman Catholics have voted, a majority of Roman Catholics have voted for the winner. And that includes several Republicans and several Democrats. But the candidate who got the most Roman Catholic vote was John Fitzgerald Kennedy, no surprise, the only Catholic president. 82% of the vote for John Kennedy in 1960, Gus, from Catholic voters.
He was a great man and a martyr and a great man. I think he probably would have been a great president, but he had no time to really do anything but learn the ropes. And by the time he learned the rope, it choked him to death.
Mm-hmm. You know, you, as you have stated on this show, no secret, Gus Weil is a man of the Jewish faith.
Yes.
And in Louisiana, of our 144 lawmakers, I don't think in the State House and Senate, we don't have any Jews. But yet there's a prominent Jewish person running for governor in Jay Darden who may very well win next year. What would that say about our state?
I tell you what, again, I'm going just to the man. I would like not to consider his and my religion. He's an outstanding guy. He reminds me a little, and I shouldn't say this about him, of Obama. They can look from now till kingdom come and not find anything negative about Jay Darden. He's what you call a clean, decent man. I think he's going to be elected governor. I also think Mary Landrieu is going to win for Senate.
Well, there are those who would disagree, including Nate Silver, and I think Mary Landrieu is in for the fight of her life, and she's had three tough ones to stay in office, but
yes.
We shall see, and we, of course, follow it here with Gus and others in the months to come, but we'll spend a few more minutes with the sage of Louisiana politics, a man who's been doing observations and insights and has the record to show for it for 56 years, Gus Weil, 297-5633, and we'll also hear from Susan Mizrucci. Her book is Brando's Smile. Back after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. Charles on North Foster, you're on the air with Gus Weil. Good morning, Charles.
Oh, good morning, Jim, and good morning, Mr. Weil.
Good morning,
I heard
son.
You come in about Baton Rouge being racially divided. I guess my opinion is that we're racially manipulated. I went before the Metro Council to propose electing a police chief, and all four African-American councilwomen voted to defer. I almost passed out at in the audience when I saw that. And I'd like your comments, but could you also tell me why our lieutenant governor, being Jewish, would pander to conservatives in Louisiana by opposing affordable health care? He really disappointed me on that. I'll hang up and listen.
The lieutenant governor, according to Charles, has backed backed Governor Jindal in refusing the Medicaid money that you said was essential to Louisiana. So, Gus, how can you back a candidate who's going to do that?
I would still say it's wrong. It doesn't matter who would fight. When you take medicine and doctors out of the lives of common people. Why not shoot them?
Mm-hmm. Well, another listener points out that Justice Governor Jindal changed his mind about the Common Core. Jay Darden changed his mind about the Stelly Plan. He was the floor leader, the man who put it through, got Governor Foster what he wanted with this plan, this tax plan, which some think was beneficial, and now Jay Darden says it wasn't revenue neutral, that it was the wrong thing to do.
If I was familiar with it, I would comment on it. I'm not.
All right. Rick Causey says, Gus, do you think Bobby Jindal has ever gotten his hands dirty doing any physical work or broken a sweat? Does he go fishing?
I think that Bobby Jindal has led a charmed life. I think he's a brilliant young man, but I think that he's a kind of a soulless person. There's no vinegar. There's no juice. Sometimes you want to shake him and say, for God's sakes, Governor, help the people. But I don't think you'd get a response.
Well, Gus, it's always a delight to talk with you. And
I thank you, sir.
God bless Gus Weil in lovely Livonia. Talk to you soon, my friend. 297-5633 is your number. And we're joined now by Susan Mizrucci, a professor of English at Boston University. She specializes in American literature, cultural history, and film, and her most recent work was The Rise of Multicultural America. And her book that she's talking about today is the definitive opus about one of the great actors of all time, Marlon Brando, Brando's Smile, His Life, Thought, and Work. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning, and thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure to talk with you. So 1943, this kid from Omaha goes to New York City. He's 19 years old, and within 4 years, he not only is a superstar, he has become an icon of renown, and there have been few stars in his realm. How did it happen?
Well, it's what I just want to emphasize that he was 23 years old when the fame hit, which is really quite incredible. I think that it's hard for us to get our mind around it, but it was a combination of talent and meeting the right mentor at the right time. He had a year of acting school at the New School with Stella Adler, the daughter of Jacob Adler. He also had a prehistory. His mother was an actress in the Omaha Playhouse in Nebraska. And so he did have a family. He was from a family of actors. So there was a prehistory. And he had a kind of charmed life as an actor, you know, in the sense that this role in Tennessee Williams' play was, as he put it, they couldn't miss.
Well, it changed his life, and there have been few film stars to equal him. What did he have? What was the magic behind the smile? This man who was only 5'8", with majestic qualities on the big screen. How did he have the it factor?
Well, I have to correct you about the height. He was actually 5'10". They seem to get that wrong in biographies, but I saw wardrobe measurements, and so he was 5'10" and 170 in his prime.
So about an average-sized man, but
average.
But he was not average when he was on the screen. I mean, he was certainly well built, and he had command. He could say things with his face without saying a word.
That's true, and he had magnetism of a kind that really was unique, a kind of charisma on stage. Arthur Miller credited him. He was one of the first to see him on stage. And what Miller said, the playwright Arthur Miller said about Brando, was that he introduced human sexuality into the theater. It hadn't been there before as a realistic process. And people who saw him in, you know, early on in his career, Laurence Olivier thought he was a genius. And he actually played Napoleon in Daisy Ray. I don't know if that's something that all of your viewers are familiar with. This was a 1954 film. And Olivier said of that performance, which he thought was far and away the best Napoleon of all the Napoleons on film and stage, that this was a genius playing a genius. And, you know, I think that Brando just had a kind of instinctive power as an actor. He had the ability to behave as opposed to acting. And he had a powerful imagination. I mean, one of the things that the book emphasizes is the mind behind everything he did. I mean, I discovered, your readers should know, that he had a library of 4,000 books, and this was a truly capacious mind. His curiosity was insatiable, and he was someone who was really interested in everything, and that mind was always behind the acting. He thought very carefully about his roles. He did heavy revising of his scripts, and he actually was responsible for some of the best lines in his movies. So these are all details that I discovered, you know, through doing my research on Brando. And, it was a combination of physical beauty. I mean, he had, as people said, all the equipment physically in terms of being, you know, handsome and also extremely athletic. But in addition, there was a tremendous intelligence and imagination behind the performances.
We're talking about Marlon Brando with Susan Mizrucci, who I think has written to this point the definitive work about Brando's life and work, Brando's Smile. Man was born April 3rd, 1924. Same day, same year, by the way, as Doris Day. And he died July 1st, 2004. So we're coming up on 10 years since his passing, 80 years old, and he lived a life that was not one of moderation. I think we can all agree on that, Susan.
Well, you know, again, it's interesting because what my book does, because I had access to materials that no biographer has seen, I saw Brando's 4,000 book library. I saw his revised scripts. I saw letters, you know, an avalanche of letters that he wrote to people, girlfriends, friends, dignitaries. There was a letter to President Bill Clinton. You know, there was a letter to the Colombian writer Gabriel Marquez. This was a man who was very much embedded in his cultural world. And there was a lot more to him. The private man was quite different from what the biographers of many of the salacious works, previous mm-hmm. salacious works about him, presented.
And, now, his closest friend, as you note quite eloquently in your book, his closest friend was Wally Cox.
That's right, yeah.
In fact, their ashes were even mixed together. Is that correct?
That's true. Wally Cox was a friend from elementary school. They met in Evanston, Illinois, at the Lincoln School. And Wally Cox was just a tremendously intelligent kid and, you know, grew into a brilliant man as well. Their letters to each other are just wonderful. And one of the things that Brando and Wally liked to do is they would go for walks in the woods and they would make up lists of their favorite words. And Brando says of Wally Cox that he taught him how to speak. He taught him to love language. And Brando rediscovered him. They met again in Manhattan in their early 20s. And it was a lifelong friendship. And Cox later came to Los Angeles, and they would take long walks in the woods around Mulholland Drive, which is where Brando's house was. And Brando he didn't want them to be separated after Cox's death. He had Cox's ashes on his mantle, and he asked that they be scattered together. They were scattered, I think, in Death Valley, mm-hmm. And also partly in Tahiti, French Polynesia, where Brando's personal island was.
Was there a romantic quality to this relationship with Brando and Wally Cox?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the one thing that I found no evidence of was homosexuality. Now, again, you know, it's one of those rumors about Brando, but the guy was such a womanizer. I mean, there were so many women, and he loved women. And frankly, I don't see how he would have had the time.
How many children did he father?
He had, my count is about 12 official children.
Mm-hmm.
He had about 6 children he adopted, or let's put it this way, I wouldn't say adopted necessarily officially, but he cared for them, he paid for their college educations, or high school, or their schooling. And then he had 6 biological children. But there were also children who were sort of known to be Brando's, and for various reasons, they weren't acknowledged, you know, for reasons in some cases that was to the benefit of the children themselves. It's complicated, but I would say about 12 in all.
In your book, you note that when Brando was a young man in New York, and he was born in 24. He runs into this guy born in 1923, and they're both nobodies at the time, Norman Mailer.
That's right. He liked, he was attracted. This was at Hector's Cafeteria in Manhattan. And he walks in, and he hears someone who looks like a real New Yorker speaking with a Texas accent. And Brando was always interested in accents. In fact, that's one of the aspects of his acting, which is so important, that he always worked very carefully on his accents. And people who knew the languages that he was, using, people who knew German, for instance, thought his accent for Young Lions was fantastic. But anyway, he heard this Texas accent from a New York-looking guy, and he went over, and he asked Norman Mailer why he was speaking in a Texas accent, and Mailer told him that that was an essential camouflage in the Army. You know, he had affected a Texas accent for self-protection when he was in the Army. With Mailer was James Baldwin, and Brando and Baldwin became fast friends. I mean, this was almost at the beginning of his time in Manhattan around 1943.
What's his best film?
That's a tough one. I love Last Tango in Paris. I'm a big fan of Byrne. This was, a movie he did in 1969, and Brando loved that film above all his films. But I have to say One-Eyed Jacks is just a wonderful film, and there still isn't a good print of it, but I would really... it's the only film Brando directed, and I would encourage all the Brando fans out there in Louisiana to go see One-Eyed Jacks if you haven't seen it before.
Well,
I think it's a great film.
Perhaps, of course, on the waterfront, Streetcar Named Desire, and Last Tango. He's known well for those, but The Godfather is probably the signature film. And March 15th, 1972 is when that film debuted. He was 47 years old. he certainly looked older than 47 by design, but he was a man whose face showed some life experience by that time.
Although he, it was makeup, and if you look at photographs of him from that period, he looks pretty young. And not only that, but he was very thin for that film. He actually had to use padding for The Godfather's paunch. That was an amazing role, and I would say that what he did there was to give all future actors what I would call a schooling in how to represent power. Power is subtle. You know, someone who is in command of every situation doesn't need to speak loudly, doesn't need to use hand gestures. You know, a simple wave of his hand, as Brando does early, in that first scene, he waves very gently to his assistant, and immediately a drink is produced for Bonacera. I think it's such a marvelously subtle performance, and all of the young actors who, were participating on it and, just spoke eloquently about Robert Duvall, James Caan, about how affected they were by watching Brando.
A final question from a listener. Was there a love of his life?
You know, he says there was. There was one woman named Jill Banner. She was actually from nearby, you know, near his hometown in Nebraska, and he said she was the love of his life. I would say that Brando was an endless romantic. He was always falling in love.
We got to roll, but thank you so much, Susan. And Quincy Jones says of this book, an important new book, My Beloved Brother, since 1951, It Makes Me Sing. We'll be back Monday. Until then, for Frank Barnett, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.